A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com. Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare Short-Term Insurance Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
This message comes from BOF sponsor eBay. You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee. And you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you feel like the gem, or sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly. When it comes to style and luxury, eBay gets it. They're making sure the things you love are checked by experts. And not just any experts, specialized experts. Real people who love this stuff with real, hands-on authentication experience. So when you see that shiny blue checkmark that says Authenticity Guarantee, shop with confidence. Every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is verified authentic through a detailed inspection. That's how you know that eBay's got your back. Because when you finally step into those sneakers, put on that watch, get your real gold glow up, swing that handbag over your shoulder, or step out in that streetwear, you'll realize that feeling is unlike any other. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit ebay.com for terms.
World of fashion, it shouldn't just be pictures from runway shows. It should be to show the way you think about things and the way you look at things. It should be a bit more lateral and a bit more unusual.
What's been the impact of the pandemic? All the stuff that has happened in the world that fashion reflects. Have you ever felt frightened or intimidated at any point?
Never, because I've got a beautiful lady at home and we've never gone like a rocket as a company. We've always been within our means. We've never overdone it.
Hi, this is Imran Ahmed, founder and CEO of The Business of Fashion, and welcome to the BOF podcast. There are very few fashion businesses, let alone an independent fashion business, that makes it to the 50-year mark in fashion. But Paul Smith is one of the rare designers to have done so. He opened his first shop in Nottingham 50 years ago and now has more than 200 stores worldwide. In the latest episode of the BOF podcast, Paul Smith speaks with BOF's editor-at-large Tim Blanks about the last 5 decades in fashion, his latest book, and how the current moment is prompting a return to craft. Here's Paul Smith, Inside Fashion.
Hello, good afternoon. Welcome to BOF Live. Today, our guest is Sir Paul Smith, who is incredibly, to me, celebrating his 50th year in business, which is just stunning. And I mean, that achievement in this industry is obviously massive. And I'm looking at Paul sitting there and I'm thinking that does look like 50 years piled up behind him.
Yeah. It's only 20 years. It's only 20 years, Tim. But I've got a big warehouse in the north of England that's got the other 30 years in it, of which there are many lovely clothes from the past. I mean, some of those early collections, sadly, I couldn't afford to keep. You know, I sell the last sample just to get some income. But I've got quite a lot of the old clothes, but not all the way back, you know.
And that archive, that kind of archive, I mean, there really aren't very many designers who could lay claim to something like that. What's your intention for it?
I mean, at the moment, we've just employed about a year ago somebody called an archivist, and she went to the archive and she said, "This is not an archive, this is a room with lots of stuff." And,
oh God.
And immediately got told off. Because it's not just clothes. There's, you know, Face magazines from the beginning, Arena, Domus magazines, furniture. A lot of the lovely things that are in the warehouse with the archive hopefully can be a contributor to the Paul Smiths Foundation, which is what we're launching today. And, you know, there's a lot of information about a lot of the old fashioned shows, press articles, graphic design. So eventually, when we completely understand what the foundation will be exactly about, at the moment it's just information for young people, but hopefully there'll be some of the archive will be used in a good way.
Do you imagine it being digitized? I mean, obviously, when people are talking about legacy for the future, you know, it needs to be easily accessed now, and that means digitalizing archives.
A lot of the almost all the fashion shows are digitalized now, available online anyway. And then slowly some of the press and some of the old lookbooks and things, which actually, it's not really to do with the legacy. It's just to do with documentation of interesting stuff, really. And hopefully people, you know, might be interested in them, hopefully.
Well, it's a time capsule, 50 years of fashion, 50 years of, I mean, you have dressed the good and the great. You've been part of the renaissance of British fashion, and the, you know, you've seen it rise and fall and rise and fall.
It was a very interesting time to start, you know. It's 1970, a very exciting time to start, because we'd just come out of the 60s, which, you know, was so full of energy and new ideas. I think, you know, based on the horror of war, which had, you know, probably we were the second or third generation after the depression of war. And I think, you know, as you know, with the Stones, the Beatles, and what was happening in San Francisco, Hyte and Ashbury, the hippies, the amazing graphic designers like Alan Aldrich, who did the Beatles, worked with the Beatles, and the Elton John. So it was a time when you sort of could just, you almost sort of were looking around to see, can I get away with this, you know, but you could. And people like Vivian, and, you know, and then eventually later on the punks and the new romantics, and self-expression through how you looked, what you did, but not political and not violent. It was very interesting that now a lot of expression of the youth are those two things, you know, political or violent. And it was just, we just looked silly a lot of the time, and it didn't really matter, you know, velvet trousers, velvet, the famous story about me making Jimmy Page's velvet trousers, you know, when I was 18 years of age, the main guy from Led Zeppelin. So
tell us how small his waist was, because my throat still closes when you tell me that. It was what,
24 inch
waist?
Oh, my waist.
God.
And the bottoms of the trousers were 28 inch. So it was like, whoop.
Every time I see Jimmy Page, I try to imagine him with a 24 inch waist. I mean, that makes
He's not much bigger now, to be honest. We're still in contact. And he's not much bigger now. He's still pretty, you know, pretty skinny guy. But 24 is very, very small. We have a bespoke service, you know, at our shop, and we make a lot of clothes for sports people. Most of their thighs are bigger than Jimmy's waist, you know. Yeah.
I mean, the man who could make Kate Moss look like divine, that's pretty extraordinary. But now, you mentioned cycling before you froze there, and of course your story begins with a bike crash, doesn't it?
That's right. Yeah. From 11 till 18, my dream was to be a professional, you know, racing cyclist, which sadly I would never have achieved because I wasn't that good. But that was my dream. You can probably see some bikes in the back here. So I'm very, I'm very connected still to the world of cycling. And that big pile of jerseys are all cycle jerseys from, you know, pretty special bike riders around the world. But I had a crash at 18, and I ended up in hospital for 3 months. And that, as they say, was the sort of the start of my interest in something called creativity and design. Completely by chance, two of the other patients in the hospital came out at the same time as me. And one of them said, let's keep in touch. And we did. And they chose a pub in my hometown of Nottingham, England, called the Bell Inn, which is complete by chance where all the art students went. And then suddenly I was meeting architects, graphic designers, photographers, fine artists, and fashion designers. And they would talk about pop art and the Bauhaus. I thought the Bauhaus was a housing estate near Nottingham. but it was just these new words I'd never heard of. Vasily Kandinsky, and it was amazing. It was just wonderful. And so I just ended up working for a girl that was opening a shop, clothes shop. And then after 6 years, I met Pauline, my girlfriend then and my wife now, who was teaching a couple of days a week in the art school, as it was called then, in Nottingham. She was ex-Royal College of Art, studied couture, fashion. And then she came to live with me and she taught me everything I know on the kitchen table at home, which is wonderful because her training was couture. It was very much about making things beautifully, understanding how to construct clothes, the importance of cut, shape, how to cut a batten, sometimes fabrics cut on the cross, on the bias. So that was the start, really. I mean, if I hadn't have had that bike crash, I'm not quite sure probably what I'd been doing. I certainly wouldn't be talking to you now, that's for sure. My dad was an amateur photographer, so I might have ended up taking pictures, maybe.
But do you believe in destiny?
It certainly has had a big part of my life, that's for sure. I mean, I think luck and then making luck or opportunity work, but you have to work at it. I'm not sure I believe in destiny, but certainly a coming together events. But a lot of people, events come together, but they don't really embrace them and make it work. And I seem to do that only because I was just so intrigued by this world of creativity and fine art and architecture. And obviously that was just wonderful that I met Pauline, and she's still absolutely my rock now, all these years later. And we're still, she's still so got so, so much clarity on what I do for a living. She's not part of the business at all, but she's just keeps my feet on the ground, and that's wonderful.
Did she introduce you to the idea of Paris fashion and all those quite highfalutin notions at that time?
Yeah, because she studied at the Royal College and she was around the same time as Peter Blake, David Hockney, Ossie Clarke, Celia Burtwell, a lot of those young artists and designers that went on to do quite well. It sounds a funny thing to say, but London was really exciting because it was, as we said earlier, it was just this brand new look over your shoulder. I can paint the house pink. I can do this. I can wear a short skirt. I can do very, amazing things. So she brought to me all that energy from London, came to live with me in Nottingham, which she was, well done her, because she really missed London. And eventually, of course, we came to live in London. But she was the one that introduced me. She used to take me to the couture shows in Paris with a couple of the students from the college. And we went to, we used to get tickets from the Chambre Syndicale, and we went to the couture shows in Paris when they were in the house of the designer with like 20 people in the audience. We saw Saint Laurent's very first collection with the smoking, when the girl opened the top and she just had a see-through top on, and there was a in the audience. So it was just so outrageous that A, she was bare-breasted, B, she was wearing a trouser suit in couture, which was the famous smoking that then Helmut Newton photographed. And I'm not sure whether you know, but Pauline, my Pauline, had the very last couture smoking that Yves ever made. He very kindly remade the one from the year we met, from 1967. And that was wonderful, amazing. And so going to all those couture shows with Chanel sitting on the stairs, or Patou, Patou and Balmain, full circle skirts, Balenciaga doing the draping. I mean, it was just a real education, it was wonderful.
I mean, incredible, from a guy who wanted to be a cyclist, like a champion
unbelievable.
Cyclist.
Unbelievable.
It just feels to me like there was, there was always something in you that to be drawn to such an extraordinary world that was so alien to Birmingham and everything else. Yeah. I mean, were you part of a gang at that point? Did you feel that you were part of a new wave?
I definitely did. Once I met the young people from the art school, then the energy was so wonderful and lovely and special. And it was so, you know, you felt like you could do anything. And of course, in music, there was amazing things happening in music around that time. I mean, I get all my dates muddled up, but, you know, as you know, Pink Floyd, you know, Zeppelin, and then later on Talking Heads, and then later on Bowie, and, you know, on all people I've worked with and know. And so there was this wonderful energy. And you did feel like you could do anything, but you couldn't, because you needed cash, you know, you needed to earn a living. So in tomorrow, 9th of April, 1970, 50 years ago, I opened my 3 meters by 3 meters shop, which actually was a room down an alleyway, and I called it a shop. And that was the start, really. And what was rather sad this week, not rather sad, very sad this week, was Kenzo passed away this week. And in my little shop in the 1971, 72, I sold a little bit of Paul Smith clothes made by Pauline, some Levi's, some Anello and David boots, which are the boots that the Beatles wore. And Kenzo, I was the first customer in Britain for Kenzo. I bought about 6 pieces and Sonia Rykiel. So I had Sonia Rykiel, either Margaret Howell or Georgina Howell, her sister, Sonia Rykiel, Kenzo, some Levi's, some Paul Smith. And that was the first little, the little shop.
Would that have been Jungle Jap? Would that have been when Kenzo was doing Jungle Jap?
Yeah, it was when his first shop. No, it was before Jungle. It was Kenzo. His little shop was in Passage Choiseul, which is a narrow little passage in Paris. And you to go into his tiny shop, you had to walk through a wardrobe door. It was so wonderful and beautiful. So that was amazing.
You know, you're just about to release this book, Paul Smith and 50 Objects.
I've got it here.
Oh, you've got it?
Now, this is an advert, everybody. Yeah.
No, I know you were friends with David Bowie, and I know he was working on a book like that, and it never came out. I would love to have seen that. Tell me about these 50 objects. How is that one per year? How do you define your career in 50 objects?
It was edited by Tony Chambers, a guy called Tony Chambers. And he said, you know, your world of fashion is not really, it shouldn't just be pictures from runway shows. It should be, you know, to show the way you think about things and the way you look at things. And so instead of just it being a coffee table book with just pictures of clothes in, it should be a bit more lateral and a bit more unusual. And so he said, please just choose 50 things. I mean, presumably that was to do with the 50 years, but you never said that. And so I very quickly chose 50 things. And I did, I say very quickly, intentionally, because I wanted it to be very spontaneous. So the first thing I chose was a camera, for instance. And it's a camera that my dad bought me when I was 11. And it was really the object that taught me to look and see, because they had these little viewfinders that you look through. Mm-hmm. And it was very much about, you know, organizing your shot, because it was film, as you know, then it wasn't digital. So film was precious, you know, you had pocket money and you wanted to get it right. So that was very much about, so I've written a little essay about why I've chosen the camera. And then through the book, there's all the various things I've chosen and a little essay about why I've chosen them. And I think some people will think it's a bit weird and odd, and other people a bit obscure. And somebody said recently, the lady from Fiden, the publisher, she said, you know, sometimes when you look at the object that Paul's chosen, you don't get the link. But when you really look at it, you just suddenly there's the understanding where that bit of lateral thinking comes from. So hopefully people will enjoy it, especially I think young creatives, hopefully, we'll enjoy it. And of course, we're launching the foundation as well today. And that's really aimed very much at teenagers who just want a bit of advice and some information based on my age and my experience that I've learned over the years. So
what's the oddest object in the book?
One of the oddest objects in the book is this, which is something that I used to take to Japan when I was bored in a meeting. and I'd get the suitcase out and it's got a train set in it. So I used to say, I am now bored. I'm
You're just a big kid. You're just
in the book, it describes that.
You're just a big kid, aren't you? Really?
Yes, 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 yes. I think it's very important. And one of the reasons for the longevity of the company is to have a childlike approach to life. Not childish, but childlike. And Bowie, for instance, when he used to come to my room, not this one, but the one across the road that had this similar feeling, he always was saying, what's that over there? Why have you got this? Why have you got that? Very curious and curious mind. And I think that having that childlike mind that's not cluttered with education or history, that but you can be more spontaneous. And I think that's why I have this very light-hearted approach, and why I've not had a nervous breakdown in this industry called fashion. You know,
you mentioned young creatives, and one thing you've done recently is you've opened up Paul Smith to young creatives to interpret it the way they see it, and it's very interesting to see what a blank slate it is for people. You know, when they approach it, why do you think that is?
I think Pauline has managed to keep my feet on the ground. And so I'm a very open person, and very often here we in this building, not sadly this year, but, you know, we have visitors from the Art Center in Pasadena. We have from the school in Rutland called the Oakham School in London, 15-year-olds. Often the building is full of students and young people coming around and enjoying the building and seeing the process of silkscreen printing or designing textiles. And so I think that openness, and nearly everything in this room is a gift from people, you know, from including the bikes and the racing jerseys. So I think that clean slate is just the fact that there's just an openness that you feel you can approach us and we'll help, you know, we'll help out. And and hopefully that's what the foundation will be, just at the beginning, just advice really. But when I first started my shop, I had no idea that it was going to be more than just a little shop. We had no plan ever. Often people say, what was your turning point or what was your special moment? And there was never been one. I mean, it's just started like this and just gradually grew. And
but you know, it's interesting because that store on Floral Street, when I think about what drew me to it originally, at the various times that I've lived in London and always ended up there, was the mix of stuff. It was the first shop that I've ever been to that felt curated in a way, that you had the clothes, you had books, you had objects, yep, you had all these different things. Before there was Corso Como in Milan, before there was Colette in Paris, there was Paul Smith on Floral Street. So,
incidentally, both those shops that you cite, Colette and Carlo Soxani, have both cited my shop in Floral Street. So you're absolutely right, as being the shop that influenced their shops, because it was they said exactly what you've just said. And many people said that it was so interesting that, you know, you go into a Paul Smith shop in Paris. I mean, Christian Lacroix said to me that, oh, I was in your shop in Tokyo and I found a book I'd been looking for.
Always.
Henri Cartier-Bresson and Matisse. Yeah. And he said, I was in your shop in Shibuya and I found that. And then a journalist said to me, oh, I found a bootleg Zeppelin album in my shop in Paris. And so, and you know how that started, though? That started from the little 3 meter by 3 meter shop. It was so tiny that when people came in, they were really on top of you. So I just needed something like, oh, I just got this. And it was just a way of breaking the ice. And that's how it really started, you know, go on a backpacking holiday with Pauline and her kids to Greece and buy some fisherman sweaters and notebooks from a school shop and a penknife from a fisherman shop. And there were just little tools to make people feel relaxed. And I got that from my father, actually. My father was such a big influence from that point of view. You know, he's very, such an easy person to talk to. And he was not confrontational at all. And he was always that managed to break the ice. You know, when you go to an auntie's house on a Sunday and you're like, you know, you're 8 years old. And then suddenly my dad had broken it. Everybody was laughing and looking at photographs he'd taken, and suddenly everything was cool. You know, I mean, that shop at Laurel Street, do you remember? Or, you know, Bruce Weber did a book signing there.
Yes.
Did, Martin Parr's done things
did
there.
Did Andy Warhol ever do anything in Laurel Street?
No, but in my little shop in Nottingham in 1972, I had an Andy Warhol exhibition in the basement, which was this smelly 3 meters by 3 meters basement called Pushpin Gallery. And I had a real soup can by Andy and some silk screens. And you know what? I couldn't afford, I never sold any of them. And I couldn't afford to buy any of them. And now I was thinking, the soup can, I remember it was £600.
Oh, do you know, they were when they were first exhibited in Los Angeles, they were $100.
I know.
And they only sold one in the show at Ferris Gallery. Dennis Hopper bought one. And then Irving Blum, who owned the gallery, went back to Dennis Hopper and said, you know what? I might as well keep the whole set. So sell me back the one I sold to you and I'll keep the whole set. Nobody else was interested. So you were on a little tip there.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact. You can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Have you ever owned something that inspired you to up your game? For me, I got a chef-grade range recently, and now I'm cooking new things every single night. Seriously, no cuisine is off limits. The point is, when we own exceptional things, they inspire us to do exceptional things. The all-new Lexus GX has an exceptional capability that will have you seeing possibilities you never knew existed. Its advanced technology and luxurious interior mean that wherever you go, you'll never go without. I can picture myself with a car full of groceries, cruising down the highway, soaking up the sun with the available dynamic Sky Panorama glass roof. Ah, pure bliss. Live up to the all-new Lexus GX. Luxury beyond limits. Experience amazing at your Lexus dealer.
This message comes from BOF sponsor eBay. You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee. And you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you feel like the gem, or sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly. When it comes to style and luxury, eBay gets it. They're making sure the things you love are checked by experts. And not just any experts, specialized experts. Real people who love this stuff, with real, hands-on authentication experience. So when you see that shiny blue checkmark that says Authenticity Guarantee, shop with confidence. Every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is verified authentic through a detailed inspection. That's how you know that eBay's got your back. Because when you finally step into those sneakers, put on that watch, get your real gold glow up, swing that handbag over your shoulder, or step out in that streetwear, you'll realize that feeling is unlike any other. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit ebay.com for terms.
That inspiration to put fashion in a context, in a creative continuum, it seems so simple in a way. But when you looked around you at that time, did you just think, this industry is missing all these opportunities to communicate with people? I mean, I've thought over the years that there must have been times when you thought, I wish that the industry was more open and more embracing of all these other different
Well, it went through this interesting period, whereas at the beginning it was mixed brand shops, you know, like Brown's in South Moulton Street in London, and it was where they had all the different brands. And then slowly the various designers said, I want my own shop on Bond Street or Madison Avenue or wherever. And so all these individual boutiques started to, as you know, is now every major beautiful street in the world now has the same set of, you know, of very luxury brands on the street. And so, but I was a single brand, but I thought, why do you just have to have your clothes there? Why can't you make it a little bit more interesting? The guy that's coming in, you know, if you're coming in, you're not just interested in that. You could also be interested in an album, you know, with, I had the Talking Heads album that was done by Robert Rauschenberg. You know, we had the vinyl, the Rauschenberg Talking Heads vinyl. You know, why? Of course you'd be interested in that. Or of course you'd be interested in a book by Patrick de Marchelier. Or, and so for me, I just kept thinking, well, it's a bit weird that people only want that, you know, but there's more to it. And of course, later on, we did get shops that sold other things as well. A lot of the designer brands just want to say their own thing, don't they, with their interiors and with their product.
But do you think that you were able to do that because you were always fundamentally an outsider?
Definitely two reasons. One is because even now, today, after 50 years, I'm still independent, which is, as you know, in the industry is quite rare, and still self-financed and amazingly still here. And then I think just the idea that you can just, being independent, you could just do your own thing a bit more and self-express, I think, not have to worry about brand image or other things. I don't think I answered the question fully. I lost my plot halfway through, so sorry if it wasn't quite right.
No, because I think it does come back to this idea about what your biggest contribution was. I mean, I asked if you were if you felt you'd always been an outsider.
Oh, that's right, you're an outsider.
Do you feel? Do you feel that's been your biggest contribution to kind of emphasize the value of independence that you've been able to do? You know, that would be.
Being the outsider has been a good point for me personally, and especially with having the security of Pauline at home, which is a big help. You know, if you've got somebody at home that, and you're not searching for things, that having that lovely foundation at home is so nice. And being the outsider is a good thing for emotionally, but quite difficult sometimes in the world we live in, because so much of it is what is expected of you, or you are this brand which promotes in a certain way and has a certain designer who's maybe well known, and you do things in a certain way. So it's very much about how people perceive you. I remember going when I first, you know, I've got quite a nice business in Japan with over 200 shops in Japan. And when I first went there in 82, I hardly spoke English at all, but I remember them saying, I won't do the accent, but can you please tell us what is your brand? Is your brand Ivy League brand? Is your brand DC brand? Which I had no idea what that meant, but apparently it means designer collective brands. And I said, I have no idea what it is. It's just, I just do. And that's how the overused phrased classic with a twist came about, because I didn't know what to say. So I just say, well, it's classic, but it's got the twist. And, you know, you look inside and you've got, you know, a bright coloured lining or a coloured buttonhole, which, as you know, is completely been imitated massively around the world. And then eventually doing photographic print, which I'm told I was the pioneer of, you know, photographs onto fabric. And so never being able to be in a box is joyful for me, but sometimes difficult from being taken seriously, you know, by a big department store or by a magazine or something. But, you know, it's never held me back, and I personally love it. And I think, you know, in terms of if there has been a contribution by myself to fashion, in the early days, it was definitely to do with nudging men into feeling comfortable about wearing clothes that were a bit more interesting, you know, and a bit of colour or, you know, it was just something that people just wouldn't, British men especially, were very nervous in the early 70s about dressing in an unusual way because they didn't want to really stand out. But then eventually, slowly, I managed to, you know, help them understand that, I think.
It must have been incredibly gratifying to be so accepted in Japan, which is just about the most aesthetic, ooh, my lisp, yeah. aesthetic culture in the world, and for them to embrace you so totally.
Yeah, it was just, it's been so humbling. It's just been, you know, I've been about 100 times to Japan, and it's just fantastic. I should be there right now, and obviously this year I can't. This is the first time I've not been since 1982, and it's just wonderful. And I mean, and I think one of the reasons why I did okay there, and we talked about destiny and luck, so many designers were invited to Japan, but in my opinion, didn't take it seriously, and were always nervous about the jet lag, demanding lots of things. And I just went thinking, this is really interesting place to be invited to. And I was just interested in the culture, the food, traveling around, and slowly almost, you know, just was there because I used to go 4 times a year, and I you know, designed the shops, they'd never done, my people that I licensed with were completely the wrong people. And that was perfect because if they'd been the so-called right people, there would have been a young group of people saying, oh, in Japan, we do it like this. In Japan, we do it like this. And I would have had a success for 3 years and then probably gone down, of which many designers did. Because my guys didn't know, they were very old fashioned, based in Osaka. I just said, eventually in a couple of years, we should open a shop. We should try and get something called editorial in a magazine. They said, what is editorial in a magazine? So, you know, it was very much about hand to mouth, but worked really, really well.
Why do you think, this has always been fascinating that the Japanese embraced you and Vivian Westwood. And it makes sense to me that you were kind of emblematic of maybe English eccentricity or something, that,
yeah,
spoke to them, and it spoke to the Japanese in some common way, but also as something seductively alien. So that's a sort of interesting.
Yeah, I mean, obviously Vivian and I know each other very well, but we couldn't be more opposite, you know, in terms of her fashion is far more extreme than mine, which is more classical. But in a way, both the way I of the events I've done in Japan and the window dressing I've done in Japan, and they're quite opposite to what people have seen before. So maybe it's correct what you say, which is there's a sort of underlying oddness or eccentricity that they love, because the Japanese people are very disciplined and very focused on doing things a certain way. So anybody who comes along and does things a bit odd often either fails miserably or does okay. And the case of Vivian and myself, we've done well, you know.
How are you going to communicate all of this through the foundation? How are you going to encapsulate all this experience in a sort of inspirational and instructional way for the people who want to follow in your footsteps?
Yeah, I think the thing with the foundation is it's literally the beginning. And so, as I said earlier, when I started my first little shop, I just thought it was just going to be a little shop. And Pauline and I never, ever thought we would sell our clothes to another shop or have a shop in London. We just never had that in our heads. It was just a way of earning a nice living. And Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, because the shop was only open 2 days, I just did other things and learnt my trade that way. And so with the foundation, I think it's really back to that little square room almost. So the first thing we've done is that people can go to the foundation website and they can look in about, you know, advice on various subjects, and then hopefully we'll give them advice either in a written form or eventually we can answer them. Now, that's not going to suddenly get them a job or do anything. All we're hoping is to start to demystify the industry so that they at least know which route to possibly consider. And it doesn't mean fashion, just fashion. It could be a graphic designer or somebody who's starting a restaurant or their own business. So, because the tips on the website could be valuable to anybody, to anybody. And they're just little things that I've learned over the years. And then I think slowly we'll realize that's really good, but we need to maybe have a bit more content, and then slowly we'll grow it. But we're not in a hurry. It's today's the first day, so it's just helping the next generation, really. That's what I want.
Do you feel a bit like Gandalf at this point? Like you're sort of dispensing the wisdom of the ages?
Well, not quite like him, but Gandalf. Yeah. I've always done what I'm doing on the foundation website. I mean, I've always done it anyway. And as I said, we had so many people in this room from colleges and schools around the world. So it's an extension of what I've always done. And then I've been just putting a bit of money on one side from the company into this thing called a foundation. So it's got a little bit of funds, not a lot. But I didn't really want to do, it's a bit like the book. I didn't want to do a fashion book. And I don't really want to do a foundation that just says, here's a large amount of money, you win a prize, or here's a month in Paris and go and work for somebody. I just wanted it to be a bit more slow and gentle and a bit more thought-provoking. And I hope that's what it will be. We'll see anyway. It's started today, and I think we had a few visitors, so that's good.
And a few more after this, I hope. So this is, you know, the wisdom of aging is something that fascinates, you know, that is part of the best thing about, one of the best things about getting older is that you acquire all this information from lived experience, you know, and that's awfully seductive and convincing or whatever when you're passing it on. But how do you feel about aging? Because as we established, you're very playful.
Yep.
And, you know, it would be instructive for me to know how you...
What's interesting for me is in this year, which is the 50th anniversary year, I'd always, even though we've had the sadness of the virus, I'd always planned to reassess my company this year and be brave enough, even though we're successful, be brave enough to reassess the company and look at some of my lovely young staff that I think I could elevate. And so I've been, and a lot of bosses are not very good at that, you know, because they think this, I'm the boss and I've always done it this way. And so around this table where I'm sitting now, in the last week or two when we've been able to come back into work, is that it's fascinating sitting with my 24 to 32 year olds, and my experience sometimes is helpful and sometimes their youthfulness and some experience is better than mine. So working out how longevity and experience can be balanced out with a new way of thinking, new way of communicating with people. And one or two things I commented on that they'd done, and then they justified it by saying whatever they said. And I think, you're right. You're absolutely right. So what's fantastic and so exciting is I can give all my experience, but they can give the youthful slant on it. So in theory, the next few years should be so exciting because it's got the solid grounding of an independent company with this lovely team of energy, which amazing. I still have two somehow. I don't know quite how, but yeah.
What's been the impact of the pandemic on your business, on your creativity? Has it, you know, limitations inspire people? Yeah. And what I've seen over the last few weeks, the sort of virtual fashion weeks, is actually, I think, the best of it has been really inspiring.
Yes, I think when you're in these difficult situations, the exciting thing is that you have to start surviving in some cases and thinking about things in a very different way. And as a company that's always had more of this lateral approach anyway, it's been very exciting. Luckily, just as lockdown happened, we are very strict with what we call our critical path of when we're designing the collection, and we're already started work on spring 22. So when lockdown happened, we had the bones of the collection. So they all went to their houses with the knitwear girl with the little bits of knitwear and the print guys with some ideas and some books I'd loan them to for ideas. And so I think the practical thing it's done for a lot of companies is made them have smaller collections. And then that whole big debate that was started with Mr. Armani, I think you'd know better than me, actually, Tim, is, about realigning the seasons and maybe having less collections, delivering clothes at a time that's a bit more sensible rather than overcoats in June, having more seasonless fabrics because of the global warming. So there's been a lot of things that have been started because people had more time on the hands to think about them and more time to actually sit down and write a letter and express their feelings. And I think that's been really, really great. And I just think the whole question of fashion shows, who knows whether, you know, the fashion show as we knew it, the fashion show at all, digital, small presentations. And, you know, my first fashion show was in 1978, and I had very little money, and it was in a friend's apartment in Rue de Vaugirard in Paris on the first floor of an apartment. And it was just charming. I mean, and it was done with, I think I had about 30 people in the audience. Some of the models were models, but some were friends. All the helpers were mates. And I just have that in my head. And I just think, how special was that? You know, the fact that when the little show was over, you know, we all just sat and chatted and had a drink. And it was just lovely. It's like, I work in my store on a Saturday in Mayfair, and it's just so lovely. Not now, because there's sadly very few people visiting from London, but, you know, not on a normal Saturday, you get people from Germany, Greece, America, China, and have a good chat. And it's how I started, you know, with the little shop and communication through down to earthness.
But, you know, confronting this situation, which is so, nobody could have anticipated this. Nothing has happened like this in living memory, that the entire world is confronting a common enemy. We always thought that the only thing that would unite humanity would be an alien invasion. It would be the only thing that would actually stress the entire planet out. But now there's this thing that unites everybody everywhere. Do you ever feel fear? Did you ever feel fear? Have you ever felt fear in the face of anything that life has thrown your way, when you seem so playful and optimistic, and yet you have been through so many ups and downs over the course of the 50 years, just all the stuff that has happened in the world that fashion reflects. Have you ever felt frightened or intimidated at any point?
Never, because I've got a beautiful lady at home, and I've got the support of stability at home. And we've never gone like a rocket as a company. We've always been within our means. We've never overdone it. I'm very old fashioned as a company. You know, my grandma used to have something like a jam jar on the fireplace, and my granddad's money went in there every week. And she knew how to spend that money gently. And I've sort of been like that all my life. The building I'm in, I own the building I'm in. I own the buildings in Mayfair. I own my warehouse in Nottingham. We've always just put the money back in. I've witnessed the 3-day coal miners strike when we only had electricity 3 days.
Yeah.
And I had to use electricity through a generator. Obviously the financial crisis. This is by far worse than anything. And we're as vulnerable as anybody. And at the moment, you know, we're okay. And we're strong, and we've got wonderful, lovely loyalty from our clients around the world in 70 countries. And that's amazing. But we're vulnerable like everybody. And nobody's escaping this. As you say, the most beautiful hotels in the world are really suffering. The biggest brands in the world are really suffering. So anybody who says they're not is unfortunately not really being totally honest, because they might still have lots of liquidity, but they're still suffering like everybody else. Having a good missus at home really helps.
Yeah, I was just going to say that the power of love, that actually if you had to, you could chuck it in and just...
I love it too much. I wouldn't be able to come in here.
Yeah. and root around in your old bike jerseys.
Yeah, I know.
You called your book, You Can Find Inspiration in Everything.
Yeah.
Which is a very inspiring, that could be the strap line of the foundation, actually. Is it? Is it the strap line of the foundation?
No, but we're writing it down as we speak.
Tim says, please. He knows nothing. What is your latest inspiration, would you say?
I mean, like many designers, you know, you do take inspiration from the obvious, you know, like a wonderful art exhibition, the colors in a painting. But sometimes it can be to do with going back to Pauline and her being taught couture fashion. And this particular season, what's been inspiring for me is the construction of, you know, we're famous for our tailoring, both for men and women. And we sell very well tailored suits, but obviously because so many people have been working from home, they've been wearing very casual clothes. But we're still doing quite well with our clothing or tailoring, as we call it in England, because I've learned so much about construction in those early days. So we've got this new jacket, you know, which is completely soft. It's got a zip in it for traveling, no pad, but it's breathable, it's shower proof. So instead of the inspiration coming from a Matisse painting, which it has done in the past, like everybody, Basque, or, you know, I can never say Basque, but anyway, you know what I mean.
I say Basquiat, but I'm probably wrong.
Basquiat, anyway, yeah, sorry. Sorry, Basquiat. So this time to do with how we make things has been really wonderful. Going back to that, I'll just show you something which is nice. This is a toile made by Pauline a few months ago, from a blank sheet of paper. So she could still make a toile, and as you know, that's all how the couturiers always worked. So I've got a lady at home that can do this. And so how inspiring is that for constructing a beautiful piece of tailoring?
Beautiful.
Wonderful.
Who does the cooking?
She's the boss all round. I do the washing up and driving.
Paul, we have time for one more question. And you know I'm a rabid David Bowie fan. So tell me an amazing David Bowie story.
Having supper with him and Iman one night, Pauline and I, Hanif Qureshi, you know Hanif Qureshi, mm-hmm. The writer who did My Beautiful Laundrette. Hanif Qureshi and his wife, David Bowie and his wife, Pauline and I, having supper, leaving the restaurant, walking down the stairs just with David and Iman, and David turning to Pauline and saying, singing, "The party's over and we're gonna call it a day." And we were like, I'm getting goosebumps now even telling you that story. I mean, and Paulie was like, David Bowie is singing to us. And the most beautiful thing, he was a nice man, beautiful man.
I'm so happy that after all these years, you can still be a major sort of fanboy, you know, you haven't lost that innocence and enthusiasm.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Paul. It was wonderful talking to you.
So lovely. And thank you very much. I appreciate it very much.
And happy 50th birthday.
Yes. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
If you've enjoyed this episode, don't forget to subscribe, give us a rating, and you might be interested in joining the Business of Fashion's global membership community, BOF Professional. Our members receive exclusive deep dive analysis, regular email briefings, as well as unlimited access to our archive of over 10,000 articles, our new iPhone app, and all of the online courses and learning materials from BOF Education.